I think, Varee, that we have a subject for discussion here that is of great importance to many people.
Yes, I agree entirely. With so many young people graduating from our schools and colleges every year, it is most essential that they choose the career and life for which they are best fitted.
And choosing the proper career is not always as difficult as it may seem, because today there are scientific tests which eliminate almost all the guesswork about whether one should be a doctor, lawyer, cook or baker, merchant prince or candlestick maker.
Well, I'm not sure, Adolf, that your recital of the old nursery rhyme was entirely accurate, but I think it gave the general idea of how vocational tests help fit the right person to the right job.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a good time to mention the fact that these vocational tests, or aptitude tests, have nothing to do with one's intelligent quotient at all. It's not that. It is simply to find out what you, as an individual, are best fitted for in life, what type of job you can probably succeed in.
Well, I think that's one of the great problems facing all parents with growing children. The lucky parent is the one who knows what his child is going to be. I know in our own case what we'd like to do with Peter. We'd like to find out as soon as we can what he is suited for. And I've been reading about the Johnson O'Connor Foundation. I think they call it the Human Engineering Laboratories, which started in 1922. They have offices here in Los Angeles and New York and in other cities, Philadelphia, Boston, I think, and Chicago. In 17 tests, I think they submit the student to, they can tell very, very soon, within a seven-hour test, where his talents lie. Whether he has,
dexterity?
Digital dexterity,
mm-hmm.
Or tonal memory, or tweezer dexterity, where he will fit. Now, as I said before, lucky is the parent who knows. For instance, we have a doctor here, whose father was a doctor, whose grandfather was a doctor. They have followed and have all been excellent doctors. Now, but supposing your boy doesn't know. I think these schools are excellent to find out. For example, a man wants to be a chemist, and he finds out that he's in the wrong business. He may be a successful chemist. What do you do in a case like that?
Well, of course, these tests that they give you, these aptitude tests, will not always discourage you. I think that if the person has some vague idea of what they might want to do, they will probably say, well, you can still do that, but in a different branch or a different field of that sort of work. This particular group of people calling themselves the Human Engineering Laboratories, they, oddly enough, want to take the children as young as 9 years of age.
I think that's very important.
That interested me particularly because I've always felt that it was the time in a child's life, when it were possible, that to find out that that is about the time when you should start more or less guiding them a little bit in that direction. And another thing that they have... another one of their tests is, how do you naturally think? Now, not how well do you think, but how do you think, which is also one of the tests they give. Oh, for example, if someone said the word chair,
mm-hmm.
Your reaction to that, the next word that would come to your mind would help them in some way to find out whether you were the type of person who thought objectively or subjectively. And those things, they say, are extremely important. It's not probably as involved as it sounds, but and the cost is rather nominal. I believe it's something like $20 for 7 hours work, and then they give you the listing, you see, as to what you are probably best suited for. Now, one of the things they brought out was the importance of vocabulary, and that I found extremely interesting because you would normally think that a professor of a university would probably have a larger vocabulary than, let us say, a bank president. But oddly enough, that is not the way it works. And they stress the fact of word value or vocabulary because, as they say, it's the words are the tools with which we make use of ideas. In other words, the larger one's vocabulary is, the chances are the greater your ideas can be expressed and the better they can be expressed.
Yes. That brings me to a very famous expression of Talleyrand, that words are meant to mask your thoughts also. That's in
yes.
the language of diplomacy. Supposing that you were a very high money earner in a bracket, but you were not too happy at the job, and you went to this laboratory here, and they said, oh, you're in the wrong business entirely. Despite the fact that you're making $50,000 a year, you should be a salesman in a store. You'd be much happier.
Well, of course, after all, in life, the important thing is finding some sort of work that will keep you and make you happy. Another thing about these tests is simply this. They claim that of all the tests that they give, that you're probably better off as an individual if you have only a few strongly developed aptitudes. I was interested in one thing that they mentioned. For example, if your son wants to be an engineer, and yet he is not able to pass his arithmetic or his higher mathematics, it doesn't necessarily mean that he will not be able to go on with his chosen work. It's quite possible he may still have great structural vision or creative imagination, that he could still go into the engineering field without doing the actual thing where mathematics is required.
Well, that's difficult to believe, but I can see your point, because he himself would then not have to do the actual work. Raymond Loewy, the great industrial designer. He does not necessarily have to know all the mathematics. He has the vision to see it. I understand that.
Well, while we've been talking about how a person may be helped in choosing a career by taking these vocational tests, I've been wondering about the many people who have some handicap that they make them fall into quite a different category.
Yes, I'm sure there are many people like that who first have to overcome some physical defect before they are ready to take up their chosen work.
You know, I've often felt that speech impediment must be a very severe handicap. But I understand today that a great strides have been made in scientific methods to overcome stammering and stuttering.
Well, I'd like to look into some of the causes of this handicap and the methods of correction. But first, I think we should pause for a moment while someone else says a few words.
I don't believe, Adolf, that we are always aware of the great number of persons who are afflicted with stammering and other speech impediments. In this country alone, you know, it has been estimated that there are over 1.5 million men, women, and children who suffer from this.
Well, stuttering as a malady has been known ever since the dawn of civilization. There is even an Egyptian hieroglyphic for it. Aristotle, Demosthenes, and I think Aesop were some of the most famous stutterers among the Greeks. But stuttering can be cured. You remember, of course, the famous case of King George, who in the early part of the war, when he was called upon to give public speeches over the radio, he had great, great difficulty in overcoming a stoppage, or a brain stoppage, I think it was. He was unable to go forward. Today, he speaks perfectly naturally. We have a very famous radio singer who has no trouble whatsoever in singing, yet in speech, she stutters, or stammers, as the case may be. I don't understand that at all, because if one stutters in speech, how can they go on and read line after line in singing without a single mistake? That is incredible.
I don't know. It is a very peculiar and a very interesting thing indeed. We do know, of course, that with little children, where you probably notice it more than with adults, there are many, many reasons for it. I think one of the main causes for small children who either stutter or stammer is usually caused by an emotional tension or an emotional insecurity. And parents, without realizing it sometimes, do more to injure that or to cause that to be extended than to stop it entirely. I think one of the best things to do, or at least so the authorities tell us, is to ignore it in little children, not to bring it to their attention.
What was the famous cure that Demosthenes had for stuttering? Didn't he put a couple of pebbles on his tongue? Wasn't that what it was? I remember someone telling me that he was a famous stutterer.
Yes, I think you're right.
As also was Emperor Claudius and Charles I of England, Charles Lamb, Erasmus, and Darwin, the great scientist. But what could that do? How could you speak with a pebble on your tongue?
Well, I think that was done a little bit. I don't think that was done for the same reason. I think that was done to improve his diction more than anything else.
But he was a stutterer.
Well, it may have been, too. But getting back to little children, I mean, therefore, you see it so often in them. And there's usually a very good reason for it. And as I said before, that so many parents are apt to say, if it happens to a small child, they're apt to stop them and say, now speak slowly. Now start over. Now take your time, dear. But that in itself is wrong, because that draws attention to the fact. And with little children, usually the reason lies in the fact that they are not able to get the words out as rapidly as their little minds are working.
Well, we know a little boy out here just exactly like that. And he's very, very bright, and I think that's the reason that in his desire, his brain is going faster than the ability of his tongue to form the words.
That's right. But there is a great deal to be done for that, and usually those children outgrow it in time.
Mm-hmm.
But for those people who are older and do not, why, of course, there are certain things, I suppose, that they can do, and there are institutions now that are helping people a great deal. I think that breathing exercises, that seems to be one of the things that is most helpful. It usually comes from a peculiar sort of a stricture within themselves, you know. Now, there are some people who, if they are very excited, will stutter or stammer. And there are other people, when they are being quite relaxed, will stutter or stammer. It depends upon the individual.
Well, one of the so-called cures is complete relaxation mm-hmm. of the throat muscles and the body and breathing. Almost anybody in excitement might stutter. But those who are afflicted by this, and it's become really a neurosis, I think a great deal of work has to be done both by the doctor and the patient. But the results have been simply amazing.
Well, now, reading aloud, of course, is a very, very good exercise because it gives quality and volume and the experience and so forth. And also reading aloud with groups of people, because I think that there's been found out that most people who have this unfortunate affliction very often become terribly, terribly self-conscious, and they don't want to be out with other people. They become rather frightened within themselves, and they're terrified of speaking. But a most interesting thing is the fact that they have discovered that with the American Indians, for example, that in interviewing hundreds and hundreds of them, that there was nothing in the tribes at any time, there was no word that was ever found that even resembled the word stuttering. And as far as they could discover, no Indian had ever stuttered.
That's very interesting.
They don't know why, unless it's a sign language. Maybe that's one of the reasons why.
Well, also, the putting stutterers together seems to ease them, so it must be something to do mentally, you see.
I think it is. I think it must be. Well, it seems that we've just gotten started in this discussion, and I see that our time is up. This is Marie Teasdale Manjou speaking from Beverly Hills.
And this is Adolphe Manjou thanking you for this opportunity to visit in your home and hoping that we may be invited to call soon again.